Thank you for having me here. It's always a great pleasure and an honor to be here at the Vedanta Society of DC. I see so many friends now that my wife and I have met as we've been coming here the last few years. And such an honor to be in this wonderful temple that came up not so long ago. So thank you very much for having me here. As Maharaj said, the occasion of my talk is this past holiday of Buddha Purnima, the thrice-blessed day of the Buddha. It celebrates three births, we could say. His physical coming into the material plane, his birth into the realm of awakening when he attained nirvana under the Bodhi tree, and then his final departure, his birth into the realm of Mahaparinirvana, the nirvana without remainder, when he left his body behind. All three celebrated on Buddha Purnima. I was explaining this to one of my colleagues at Elizabethtown College, who is not so well-versed in the traditions of India. And he said, wow, he did all that in one day. That's really remarkable. No, same date, but different years. But the Buddha was, of course, incredibly accomplished. And this is why we still talk about him 2,500 years after his time. I want to focus today on the harmonies between the teaching of the Buddha and Vedanta. One of the central teachings of Sri Ramakrishna, Swami Vivekananda, a favorite topic of mine, is the harmony of religions. It's an idea that's often misunderstood. Sometimes you'll hear people say very casually, all religions are the same. Well, if they were all the same, we couldn't tell them apart. Right? That's sort of a basic error that one could point out. If you're in the Indian philosophical tradition, you know, if there's no lakshana, right, if there's no characteristic differentiating something, then there's no difference. But there are differences. But harmony assumes difference. Right? When there's harmony, that means we have maybe different voices singing different parts, different instruments in an orchestra playing different parts, but they harmonize. They come together in a way that makes a beautiful music if we have the ear for it, right? If we listen in the right way. Now, with Buddhism, we have a very interesting case, I think, where the not only harmony, but even similarity and actual sameness to some extent is quite a lot we can see between Vedanta and Buddhism, that many of the same teachings, many of the same assumptions are there, because the Buddha came from India at the same time that, and we have beautiful harmony coming out now too, music. The Buddha lived at the same time that the Upanishads were being written down, when Vedanta philosophy was being taught. And from the perspective of Swami Vivekananda, what the Buddha taught really is a variation of Vedanta philosophy. So one can see not only harmonies, but actual similarities. Now, there are also differences between Buddhism and Vedanta. And there's a very good scholar named Richard King who characterizes this very nicely. He presents Vedanta and Buddhism as mirror images of one another. A mirror image looks the same in many ways as the thing that it's reflecting, but it's also a reversal of the thing that it's reflecting, right? Left is right and right is left. You know, if you saw, most of us are used to seeing a reflection of ourselves, but if we actually see ourselves as others see us, we look a little funny, right? Most of us don't like the way we photograph or the way our voice sounds when we're recorded. So you could see this, I think, in the following way, that Vedanta very often starts with the self, starts with Brahman, starts with the supreme reality. And then we work from there to, you know, why is it that we experience things as we do so often in the realm of phenomena? And then the idea of Maya is introduced to explain that. Buddhism, in some ways, presents the same picture of reality, but starts in the opposite direction. Starts with the present experience, the present moment, which is characterized by change and impermanence and passing away, and moves from there to that which is beyond change and impermanence. So it's not that they conflict necessarily, but that they're reaching the same point from a different starting point, you could say, from a different direction. There's one way I sometimes like to characterize this idea of harmony. Sometimes teachings may sound as if they conflict. We hear Buddhists say a lot about impermanence and change. We hear teachers of Vedanta talk a lot about that which is changeless and unborn and eternal. It sounds on the surface like they're saying two different things. But if you ask the question, how do I get to Pittsburgh? The answer is going to differ depending on where you start, right? If you're starting from Elizabethtown, Pennsylvania, people will say go west, right? You get on the turnpike and you go west to Pittsburgh. But if you're in Chicago, where I used to live, and someone says, how do you go to Pittsburgh? Well, you go east, right? You get on Highway 80 and go east and head to Pittsburgh. Now, east and west, those sound like contradictory statements. But if I'm dogmatic, if I'm in Elizabethtown and I insist that the one true path to Pittsburgh is to go west, and I tell my friend in Chicago, you have to go west to go to Pittsburgh, then my friend in Chicago has to cross the whole United States, the Pacific Ocean, Russia, Europe, the Atlantic Ocean, New Jersey, most of Pennsylvania, and then finally arrive at Pittsburgh. They can do it, but it's going to take them an awfully long time. But the great teachers in the world's traditions know which way is best for their followers, for the people to whom they're speaking. So they'll tell you, if you're spiritually in Elizabethtown, go west to go to Pittsburgh. If you're spiritually in Chicago, they say go east to go to Pittsburgh. So permanence or impermanence, these starting points really depend on those of us who are practicing, what is best for us. Another image I'll give you is one which Swami Tyagananda gave me a few years ago. I don't know if you've met him. Many of you, I think, have. But Swami of the Ramakrishna Order, who's based in Boston. And we were walking along Cape Cod by the ocean. And he said, try to see the ocean without seeing the waves. And this was, of course, a very profound statement. You know, try to see the unchanging beyond the realm of change. And a Buddhist would probably tell you to look at the waves, right? Look at the present moment, look at the changing moment, and then see to the depth. So the same basic model of reality, but coming from different starting points. Swami Ranganathananda, another Swami of the Ramakrishna Order, has written that the self-transcending ethics of unselfish love and compassion of Buddha and his movement, united to the philosophy of the transcendent self of Shankara's Vedanta, is the new thought, the new Vedanta, which is energizing and stimulating India's mind and heart today. This is in a thin little volume that he wrote called Bhagavan Buddha and Our Heritage. And it's a wonderful book. It's a very striking book, especially if you come from a perspective, as many of us do in the West, where Vedanta, or as it's often called, Hinduism and Buddhism, are presented as two different religions. You know, you have a textbook on world religions, and there's a chapter on Hinduism, there's a chapter on Buddhism, there's a chapter on Christianity, there's a chapter on Islam. And you say, wait a minute, why is a monk of the Ramakrishna order talking of Bhagavan Buddha, right? Lord Buddha. And this confuses people sometimes. And I often talk in this same way, so that about half the people at my college think I'm a Buddhist. And, you know, I always have to explain to them, well, actually, it's more like Hinduism, you know, it's Vedanta. And, you know, it reminds me of, I don't know if any of you have ever seen the cartoon animated series, The King of the Hill, but there's a family who moves into a small town in Texas, and they're from Laos in Southeast Asia. And the main character of the series is this man named Hank, who's grown up in a small town in Texas. So he goes to meet this new family from Laos. And so he approaches them using the categories he can understand. So he says to them, are you Chinese or are you Japanese? And they explain, well, we're from Laos. It's a small country in Southeast Asia, so we're Laotian. And Hank processes this for a few seconds, and then he says, so are you Chinese or are you Japanese? And he's not quite able to process this concept of Laotian. So in the same way, Vedanta, we may think of it as a Hindu system. It's rooted in the Upanishads, rooted in the Vedas. But Buddha has a place, a very prominent place, from a Vedanta point of view. And as Swami Ranganathananda has characterized it, you could see the Vedanta of today, the Vedanta taught by Sri Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekananda, as in many ways a kind of fusion of aspects of Buddhism and aspects of Shankara's Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta. Swami Vivekananda himself elaborates upon this. He says, "The Vedanta philosophy is the foundation of Buddhism and everything else in India. But we call the Advaita philosophy, what we call the Advaita philosophy, has a great many conclusions of the Buddhists. The Vedanta has no quarrel with Buddhism. The idea of the Vedanta is to harmonize all." Swami Vivekananda basically sees Buddhism as coming out of Vedanta, but also sees Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta in particular, as owing something to Buddhism. And what he's just put into a couple of sentences here is roughly 1,500 years of Indian cultural history enunciated in a very concise way. If you look at India at the time of the Buddha, some of the core concepts that the Buddha taught were already present in the teaching of Vedanta. In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, widely seen by scholars as the oldest of the Upanishads, in the fourth chapter of the fourth book, the 12th verse, it says, "Desire being the root of rebirth, when desire is eliminated, rebirth vanishes along with it." This is a core teaching of Buddhism as well, that desire leads us to action. Action infused with desire leads to the fruit of action, which leads to rebirth. And if you remove the element of desire from action, then no more fruit of action, no more rebirth. That is the core teaching of both of these traditions, the core insight that unites them both. Buddhism took this in a particular direction, a community and a tradition formed around it, and it was engaged in extensive dialogue and sometimes quite heated debate with Hindu schools of thought. But one of these schools of thought, Advaita Vedanta in particular, also absorbed and accentuated many of these elements shared with Buddhism. So much so that other systems, followers of other systems of Vedanta, sometimes thought Shankara was too Buddhist. So they were like the people at my college who think I'm a Buddhist. They thought Shankara was a Buddhist because he talked about things like impermanence of the phenomenal world and other similar language. The main contribution that Swami Vivekananda sees in Buddhism is as being a reform movement. He doesn't see it as something that is in flat contradiction of or against or separate from the wider Hindu tradition from which it came. Swami Vivekananda says, his was, that is the Buddha's, in the first place, not the founding of a new religion, but a movement of reformation. He believed in the good of all. And then Swamiji encapsulates the Four Noble Truths, which are seen as Buddhist as the foundational teaching of Buddhism. The first thing the Buddha did after he had attained nirvana, first he had to decide whether to share this insight with others. And according to the Buddhist scriptures, there was a moment when he doubted whether he should share this, that it's very subtle doctrine, people will misunderstand it, they'll establish a religion around it, and then they'll fight with each other about it. So maybe I should just keep my mouth shut and sit here under the tree. And then it said that because of his great compassion, he was moved to go and share this teaching. And there's another version of the story, in fact, where the Vedic deities, Indra and Brahma, both go to the Buddha and they say, many will misunderstand your teaching, but many will get liberated by it. So please do go and share it. And it's interesting that you have Indra and Brahma as characters in the life story of the Buddha. In fact, they appear more than once. They also help the Buddha when he's not yet the Buddha, when he's still Prince Siddhartha living in his father's palace surrounded by luxury. And when he realizes that he needs to become a renouncer and follow the life of a sannyasi in order to really get at the truths that he wants, it's said that Indra sent down a mist and put everyone to sleep in the palace so that young Siddhartha could escape. His father always wanted to keep him from going and becoming a monk because there was a prophecy when he was a baby that if he saw the suffering in the world, he would want to, he would, his heart with, would fill with compassion, and he would want to become a monk and teach everyone the way to salvation. So his father said, well, we're not going to have any of that. He wanted his son to inherit his throne and become a great king. And the other part of the prophecy was that he would, if he didn't become a great enlightened monk, he would become an emperor. So his father always tried to keep him sheltered and surrounded only by happy and good things. So he escaped with the help of Indra. So you don't see these two traditions so much as being in antagonism at a certain point. You know, there are the Vedic devas helping the Buddha become the Buddha. So after he decided to teach, it's said that he went to Sarnath near Banaras, and there he met five monks, and he had previously been practicing with these monks very, very severe austerities, almost starving himself to death, practicing a very, very strict path. And he developed a lot of control, you could say, of mind over matter by doing that, but it didn't show him the way to enlightenment. He just realized that he was very, very thin and very, very sick, and he decided to follow what he called the middle path between indulgence of the life of a householder or the very, very severe self-deprivation that he and his five friends were following. So when he began to eat regularly and behave a little more in a moderate fashion, following the middle path, these five monks abandoned him. They decided he had left the true path. So they saw him coming, and their initial reaction, rather like high school students, was to say, well, we're not going to talk to him. He's not following the right path. But they could tell there was something different about him. There was a light emanating from him. There was a radiance and a calm that they had not seen before. So against their conscious wishes, they gravitated to him. And he spoke and he taught a sermon. And this sermon, it became the foundation of all forms of Buddhism thereafter. It's a very brief statement. It's called in Sanskrit, really the fourfold noble truth. But in English, we often call it the four noble truths. And Swami Vivekananda summarizes it in the following way. He mentions the first three noble truths. He says of the Buddha, his religion as formulated by him consisted of the discovery of three things. First, there is an evil, right? There is an evil. In the Buddhist tradition, this is called suffering. The word you see in Sanskrit or in Pali is dukkha, which just means suffering most of the time. But it also has a more technical meaning in Buddhism, which should resonate with us if we follow Vedanta as well, because dukkha is not only suffering in our usual sense. There is suffering in life, right? There's a lot of suffering in the world. We all experience some amount of suffering, some amount of sorrow, the sorrow of loss, the sorrow of disease, the sorrow of not getting what we want. But dukkha also means impermanence, the constant changeability of everything. So the Buddha himself explains this. The original wording of the first noble truth is sarvam dukkham sarvam anityam. All is suffering, all is impermanence. Everything is going to pass away. Second, what is the cause of this evil? This he ascribed to the desires of men to be superior to others, an evil that could be cured by unselfishness. This is Swami Vivekananda's paraphrase of the second noble truth. The second noble truth is the truth of the cause of dukkha. The cause of suffering is not simply the fact of impermanence. That's just the way the world appears to us. But the problem is our desire to have certain kinds of experiences, our grasping and craving for certain kinds of experiences. We come to a point where there's a state of affairs that we really like, and then we want reality to just freeze at that moment so that it can be that way forevermore. But reality doesn't do that. It keeps flowing. It keeps changing. So I give the following example to my students. I ask them, you know, what they were doing in high school. And they were working very hard and studying very hard and getting involved in extracurricular activities so they would be well-rounded and it would look good on their college application. And I say, what was your goal? Well, their goal was to get into college. So I then tell them, okay, so you're in college now, so life is good, right? You're happy. That's it, right? No, they're working even harder now. And I say, well, why are you working now? Well, they want to get a job when they get out of college. And so I tell them, so when you get a job, then you'll be happy, right? All your problems will be solved. You know? And, you know, some of them kind of hope so, but they sort of know what's coming next. And I give them a little bit of life experience that I think most of us have had. You know, you get your job, and first of all, you may not get a job right away. And then when you do, maybe you don't end up liking your job as much as you thought you would. Maybe you like your job, but you don't like the people you work with. Maybe you like your job, but you're not making enough money to do the other things you want to do, like have a house, for example. So you work really hard and you make enough money to buy a house. So now you have a house, so now you're happy, right? Well, a few days ago, my wife started hearing these sounds in our house. And we realized that birds were flying into an air vent, and the outer barrier, there was a screen that had been on that air vent, and it had gotten blown away in one of the storms that we had not too long ago. So the birds were happily flying in and out and getting ready to build their own house inside of our house. So I had to get up there with a broomstick and, you know, clear out the, luckily there were no birds in there when I went up there, get the, you know, beginnings of a bird nest out of there, you know, and go to the hardware store and buy the screen and put it on the house, you know. So, no, getting the house is not the end of suffering. It's the beginning of many kinds of suffering. So we householders, you know, this holding of a house, right, this grasping onto things is the cause of many, many forms of suffering. When I return to Elizabethtown this afternoon, I'm going to have to mow my lawn. That was something else I noticed before I left yesterday. So we constantly desire. We want things to be a certain way, but the world keeps changing, so we have to keep doing things. We have to be constantly engaged in activity in order to arrive at this state of happiness, which doesn't really seem to arrive, or it arrives, but then it passes because we again then have to do something else. And the Buddha also had very keen psychological insight. It's not only the external world that's changing. In fact, another thing I have been taught by Swami Tyagananda is that your external experience is a mirror of your consciousness back to you. It's our mind that's actually changing all the time. So you get everything you want, and then you're bored, right? Because you want something else, because your mind is now on to some other object of desire. So these are the first two noble truths, and these are Vedantic teachings as well. There's nothing here that is unique to Buddhism. And as Swami Vivekananda said, one of our chief desires is our desire to feel superior. We have a sense of self, and we put great importance on this idea of self. And elsewhere, Swami Vivekananda says, the giving up of the self is really the way to happiness, according to Buddhism. The self does not exist, according to Buddhist teaching. This evil, this dukkha that we experience, is curable by becoming unselfish. Now, here we come to one of the topics where Buddhism and Vedanta seem to part company. I say seem to, but I don't think that's entirely the case. I think this is actually a situation where there is difference, but difference that we can learn from. Because in Vedanta, of course, we talk about the self a lot, the Atman, Paramatman, the supreme self, the supreme soul. Buddha says there is no self. This sounds like he's denying the central teaching of Vedanta. But this teaching of no self does not necessarily refer, I would like to suggest, to the self that we're talking about in Vedanta. I think that he's talking about the self that we identify with as this body and its experiences. And what he's teaching actually is a very deep Vedantic truth. And in fact, in the song that we sang this morning, there's a reference to the idea of neti, right? The path of negation. If you look at what the Buddha actually teaches, it's not, if you look at the original Buddha scriptures, it's not so much there is no self. I have a hard time finding any statement to that effect. What one finds is a questioning process. The Buddha will say to his followers, is this body the self? And then they'll entertain that idea that the body is the self, and they'll realize after a while that there are problems with that. And then he'll ask about each of the senses. Is the sense of sight the self? Well, no, not really. Is the sense of hearing the self, the sense of touch, smell, taste, and then finally you reach the mind. Is the mind the self? Well, no, the mind's not the self either. None of these things are the self, because self always meant in India something unchanging, something eternal, something uncreated. And all these things that we point to and think of as our self are all impermanent. They're all part of this realm of dukkha. So that if we grasp after them, we're creating more suffering and more rebirth for ourselves. So what he's doing is negating. He's saying, this is not the self, that is not the self. The self is, and here we have to be a little bit clever, it's not nothing, but it's no thing, right? Think of nothing with a little hyphen, right? It is not anything that we can identify, anything that we can point to and know with our mind, but it can be realized, it can be experienced. It's the foundation of all knowledge. Elsewhere in his complete work, Swami Vivekananda makes a very striking claim. He says, no one can know God, he says. And this is also somewhat jarring. I mean, we have a book in the Vedanta tradition called How to Know God, right, by Swami Prabhavananda. The first thing that Sri Ramakrishna told Swami Vivekananda when they met was that he had seen God, in fact, and saw him more vividly than he saw Swamiji sitting in front of him. And this text of Swami Vivekananda's, this statement is interpreted to mean, and from the context you can see that it means, that he's talking about knowledge with the mind, knowledge in our conventional sense of knowledge. But the knowledge that Sri Ramakrishna had, the knowledge that we are trying to gain through Vedanta, is not knowledge in that conventional sense. It is a deeper realization. And here's where the original language is very good to be attentive to, right? You have jnana, or gyan, knowledge, but then there's vijnana, or vijnan. And that vijnana is really the kind of realization we're talking about. That prefix vi sometimes means not, right? So like a videshi is someone who's a foreign person in India, for example, right? Not deshi. So vijnana is not knowledge, but it's also not ignorance. It's the knowledge beyond knowledge, right? Or if we're using English, right, knowledge with a capital K as opposed to with a lowercase k. Of the self with a capital S as opposed to the self with a lowercase s. The changing cluster of body and mind and senses that we tend to think of as self. That is what the Buddha is saying is not self. But that doesn't mean he's denying that there is this deeper reality. Now, sometimes people are skeptical about this because the Buddhist arguments against self are very, very strong and very persistent through the tradition. But in one of the Buddha's earliest sayings, it's in the Pali scriptures in a text called the Udana, he says the following. The Buddha says, there is that which is unborn, uncreated, unformed, and unconstructed. If, bhikkhus, if, O monks, there was not this unborn, uncreated, unformed, and unconstructed, no escape from what is born, created, formed, and constructed could ever be realized. But since there indeed exists that which is utterly unborn, uncreated, unformed, and unconstructed, the escape from this born, created, formed, and constructed state can therefore indeed be realized, explained, and made known right here and now. So there is that which is not constructed. And that's what in the Vedanta tradition we call the self, the Atman, which is identical to Brahman, the infinite reality. Now, the Buddha does not go on and say that, right? He doesn't use this label Atman. Because people speculate about this, but my own sense of the Buddhist tradition is that the Buddha's feeling is that if we even use the word self at all, we're going to be infusing the way we think about these things with our idea of lowercase s self, with ego. So he says, just don't use the term self at all. It is that which is unborn, uncreated. And in Vedanta, we say self. So there's the difference between Buddhism and Vedanta, I think, in a nutshell. It's not so much a deep, irresolvable difference as maybe a different strategy, right? A different way to Pittsburgh, right? East or west. In fact, there's a later Buddhist scripture. It's not clear if the Buddha actually said it, but it's very much in the spirit of the Buddha, where he says, to those who believed in self, I taught no self. And to those who believed in no self, I taught self. In other words, it's any idea that we get attached to that is the problem. It's not self or no self. It's, do I think I'm right? And if I think I'm right, then I'm reaffirming Mr. I, Mr. Ego. And that's not what Buddhism is about, and that's not what Vedanta is about. It's not about being right. That's a very small way of thinking. It's about cosmic consciousness. It's a realization much beyond I'm right and you're wrong or vice versa. So this is the understanding, I feel, of Buddhism that is very much in harmony with Vedanta. Now, besides the first three noble truths, the fact that there is suffering, that suffering is caused by our desire and our grasping, and that it's possible to become free from this suffering by becoming free from grasping. There's also the fourth noble truth, which is the way to that realization. It's called the Eightfold Path in Buddhism. If you ever see pictures of the Dharma Chakra, the eight-spoked wheel that is the symbol of Buddhism, that's the symbol of the Eightfold Path. It's a wheel with eight spokes because it's not an eight-step program. Right? It's not saying first do this, then do number one, then do number two, then do number three, then do number four. It's eight paths, really. Eight things that you're doing simultaneously in life. These are called right understanding, right action, right motive, right speech, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. Was anyone counting? I think I got all eight. And again, there's nothing in those which really contradicts Vedanta. I mean, right understanding is perceiving reality in the way the Buddha taught, right? Looking beyond phenomena and going for the unborn, the uncreated. Right motive is basing our actions on a right understanding. Right speech, speaking in harmony with truth. And not only truthfully in the kind of literal legalistic sense of not telling a lie, but using our speech in a way that's beneficial for all, because we're all connected, we're all interdependent. The right attitude to hold toward others is one of compassion, to see ourselves in others and others in ourselves. So even if something's true, you don't always have to say it. Right? There are a lot of contexts where it's just better to be silent. So, you know, right speech is about that. Right action, and then there Buddhism has its five precepts, which are almost identical to the yamas, the restraints that you see in the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali. Nonviolence, telling the truth, not stealing, having self-restraint. And then the last one in Patanjali is aparigraha, not grasping or not being materialistic. In Buddhism, it's not using intoxicating substances. So that's a slight difference. But even there, it's not something that is contradictory to Vedanta. Right effort, right livelihood, these are all concepts we have in Vedanta as well. Mindfulness, meditation. So it's all very Vedantic, actually, if you look at it closely. The way that Swami Vivekananda summarizes this fourth noble truth, how do we get to the state of desirelessness? Swamiji says, force, the Buddha concluded, could not cure it, could not cure this ailment of desire and suffering. Dirt cannot wash dirt. Hate cannot cure hate. This was the basis of his religion. And here I find that Swami Vivekananda is actually paraphrasing a very early Buddhist text called the Dhammapada. The fifth verse of the first chapter of the Dhammapada says, hate can never be overcome by hate. Only love can overcome hate. And here's a very striking thing. If you don't translate all of it into English and read the original, after he says, only love can overcome hate, he says, this is Sanatana Dharma. This is the eternal law, or the eternal truth, is how it's translated. Now, interestingly, we use the term Sanatana Dharma also to talk about the Hindu tradition. But one of the earliest, maybe the earliest, but I'm not quite sure about that, but certainly one of the earliest places in any text where we see the term Sanatana Dharma is right here in the Dhammapada. So if anyone asks you, what is Sanatana Dharma, you can say, hate can never be overcome by hate. Hate can only be overcome by love. This is Sanatana Dharma. This is what the Buddha said. So the core of his teaching in terms of how we should live is that we should live lovingly. Why love? Because we're all one, right? Because we're all interconnected. And again, that's a deep Vedantic truth as well. The oneness of existence, the oneness of being. The very next verse is also, I think, a very profound one. The Buddha says, there are those who are not mindful of death, but those who are mindful of death among those who are mindful of death, all quarreling ceases. Now, this verse used to puzzle me. What does it mean to be mindful of death? Very often, especially Westerners who read Buddhism, think it sounds very gloomy. There's a lot of talk of suffering and death. Well, what does it mean to be mindful of death? And why would you stop quarreling if you were mindful of death? And what has made me understand this verse is actually an event from my own life. When I was 12 years old, I was going to go out to play. I was going over to a friend's house. My father had been in a very bad accident. He was in a wheelchair, actually, and he was not able to really move by himself. He could control the wheelchair with his mouth, actually. And when I was going to play with my friend, I said, "I love you, Dad." And he said, "I love you too, son." And I left. And that was the last time I saw him. When I came home, I arrived at the same time as my grandparents were arriving to tell us he'd been in another terrible accident. He'd gone out with his wheelchair. And so I've always been grateful that the last thing I said to my father was, "I love you." That was the last interaction I had with him. And as much sorrow, as many feelings and experiences as I've had about my father and his passing away when I was young, one feeling I've never, ever had is regret. I have no regret. My last words to him, his last words to me, were loving. And to be mindful of death and why it is that all quarreling would cease among those who are mindful of death is if you realize that any time you're talking with someone, that might be the last time. That might be the last time. It's not a gloomy thought. It's not a depressing thought. It's realistic. I know because I had this experience. So talk to everyone as if it's the last time you're going to see them. You know, be loving and kind. Be mindful of death. And if we were all mindful of death, maybe we'd be a lot nicer to each other in this world. And it reminds me of something from the tradition I grew up in. There's a saying in the New Testament, don't let the sun go down on your anger. Also, I think very good advice. You know, resolve everything if you can. You know, maybe the other person isn't ready to, fine, but you have to show you're willing to resolve the problem. Otherwise, you'll always regret, you know. And I could even tell you another story. I also had two uncles who got into a big fight after the funeral of my great-grandmother. I was just 2 years old at the time. I don't even remember this, but I was told about it. But for 35 years, they did not speak to each other. And then one of them died. They never did reconcile in this life. I personally think they'll both have to come back, if for no other reason that they need to work this out. But, you know, how much regret one must have, you know, to have lost an opportunity like that with another person. So this is the way to freedom, according to the Buddha, that we show love, we show compassion, we live out of a sense of our oneness, our interconnectedness, and we don't get too attached to any of these changing circumstances that make up our life and our mental experience, because it's just going to keep changing all of the time. Experience the change, appreciate each moment for what it is, because it is unrepeatable. That moment will not come back again. Finally, well, two more points I would like to make. One has to do with this attachment to objects and to experiences. As I said before, when I was quoting the Upanishads, it's action infused with desire that leads to rebirth, that leads to more of the same kinds of experiences. In the Bhagavad Gita, we also see the idea of detachment from the fruits of action. That's the idea, that you are removing that energy of desire from your action, called karmapala vairagya in the Sanskrit language, the renunciation of the fruits of action. And Swami Vivekananda said of this, he said, "In every religion we find one type of self-devotion particularly developed, the type of working without a motive, that is karmapala vairagya, is most highly developed in Buddhism." So Swami Vivekananda had very positive things to say about Buddhism in this regard. He didn't simply say, "Karmapala Vairagya, see Bhagavad Gita chapter 3, right? Which, of course, that's where it is. But he complimented Buddhism as having really cultivated this particular virtue. And then finally, there's the one that most of my students know. It's the one you find in the high school textbooks. But it's the fact that the Buddha taught the irrelevance of what some call the caste system, or the station in life to which one is born, to spiritual pursuits. He said that birth caste is irrelevant to spiritual attainment. And again, to quote Swami Vivekananda, Buddha preached the most tremendous truths. He taught the very gist of the philosophy of the Vedas to one and all without distinction. He taught it to the world at large because one of his great messages was the equality of man. Men are all equal. Every man and woman has the same right to attain spirituality. That was his teaching. The difference between the priests and the other castes he abolished. He opened the door of nirvana to one and all. So again, it's not that Buddhism or the teaching of the Buddha contradicts the Vedas. In fact, it comes from the very heart of the Vedic teaching. But the practice of his time was to confine this teaching to a small elite few. And the Buddha said, no, I'm going to teach it to everyone. I'm going to show it to everyone. And in fact, this system of inequality is not what's really taught in Vedanta either. Another quote of Swami Vivekananda, the caste system is opposed to Vedanta. Caste is a social custom, and all our great preachers have tried to break it down. From Buddhism downwards, every sect has preached against caste. Caste is simply the outgrowth of the political institutions of India. It is a hereditary trade guild. And a nice verse, again, from the Dhammapada that we can juxtapose with that is, not by birth does one become a Brahmin. A Brahmin is one who is pure, in whom there is truth and dharma. So it's our qualities as human beings that make us fit or unfit for these teachings and for understanding them. It's not that I can tell when you come in the door, oh, this is your last name, this is your job, this is your place in society. Okay, you can come in, but you can't. It's not like that. We can all come in, and each person is going to receive it as they are ready or not. And so the Buddha opened it to everyone, taught it to everyone. And again, we can see Swami Vivekananda as following in the footsteps of the Buddha. Not only would he teach to everyone in India, regardless of caste or class distinction or religion, he came all the way to this country to teach us folks about Vedanta. And some of us were ready and some were not, but here we are in the Vedanta Center of Washington, D.C., capital of the United States, studying the Buddha and Swami Vivekananda. So the teaching is out, right? The proverbial cat is out of the bag, and we're all the better for it. So thank you very much, and namaste, namaskar, and good morning.